I'm Nick Harvey Doyle, an Anawan man from the northern tablelands of New South Wales. The Yarn podcast is made on the unceded land of the Wurundjeri, Woiwurrung, and Bunurong people. We'd like to acknowledge First Nations people as the first storytellers. We pay our respects to elders past and present. Always was, always will be, Aboriginal land.
From the Centre for Advancing Journalism at the University of Melbourne, this is The Yarn. I'm Thomas Phillips. Our team at The Yarn was honoured to receive the Climate Award at this week's Australian Podcast Awards. A massive thank you to those who have contributed to our climate coverage, especially Clancy Balin, Jordan Beasley, Jenny Tsai, Angus Thompson, Amelia Hart, and Louisa Lim. And thanks also to the Science Gallery for its continued support. Today, we're bringing you the third episode of our News Bites series. It spotlights the journalism of staff and students at the Centre for Advancing Journalism. This week's guest is The Yarn's executive producer, Louisa Lim. Louisa is a senior lecturer who spent a decade as an audio journalist in China working for the BBC and NPR. During that time, she was on the ground for some of the region's most consequential events, including the aftermath of the 2008 Sichuan earthquake. More recently, she published a book about Hong Kong called Indelible City and produced a related podcast series for the ABC called The King of Kowloon. The latter tells the story of a Hong Kong folk hero whose distinctive graffiti turned him into a revered outsider artist. For News Bites, she spoke with Jeff Sparrow about reporting from China and her process for audio storytelling and long-form writing. Jeff started by asking Louisa how and why she became a journalist.
Well, I didn't really want to be a journalist. My actual aim was to be a literary translator. But so I studied modern Chinese studies at the University of Leeds. And then after I graduated, I went to Beijing and I worked in a publishing company as a translator. And it was the most boring job I've ever done. I had really long lunch hours and really short working hours. And just at the time—
I'm not seeing the problem.
Well, just at the time that I was there, the first independent English language magazine opened up in Beijing. And I just had so much time on my hands. I was translating really boring books about archaeology and Chinese medicine and stuff like this and polishing them and editing them. And I just wanted to do something else. So I started going out and interviewing all these people that I wanted to meet, you know, film directors and authors and just really interesting people. And then I realized this is what I want to do. So I went to Hong Kong. I worked first in newspaper, which only lasted 6 months. Then I joined a TV station and I worked there for a few years. And then I decided I needed to get proper training to figure out how to be a journalist. So I went to London. And I actually started work experience at the BBC World Service. And I was going to go and do a master's at Columbia. I was kind of on my way there, but then I got maternity cover. And so I just never left the BBC until I was reporting from their Beijing office. I just continued all the way. And so then I worked for BBC for a few years. I was sent to Beijing, and then I was poached by NPR, and I spent 7 years as their China correspondent.
So a varied career as a journalist. If you had to nominate a highlight of your time as a reporter, what would it be?
Oh, that would be hard. A lot of highlights, a lot of really fun and interesting things. Probably the weirdest and most interesting experience was going to North Korea. I went twice as a journalist, one time semi-illegally and one time legally. And those were really bizarre and interesting experiences. The second time was the parade where Kim Jong-un was unveiled to the world. And so there was sort of gigantic military parade through the streets of Pyongyang. And there were so many journalists there, they didn't have enough minders to mind us, because you're meant to be followed everywhere by translators and minders. But they didn't have enough, so we were kind of allowed to roam free. And that was just a weird and fascinating experience. Another high point, or possibly a low point, was covering the earthquake in Sichuan in 2008, where 88,000 people were killed. And that was just a really interesting journalistic experience. And it was also really interesting watching the aid effort and how quickly it was unrolled. And because I was based in China at the time and we kept returning to the same places to see how the rebuilding effort was going, that was also a really interesting experience.
One of the themes of this discussion, I think, is going to be your work across a variety of different modes. So I wanted to touch on that now. In 2014, you wrote your first book, The People's Republic of Amnesia. What prompted the shift away from short-form journalism to long-form book?
Oh, it was just opportunistic.
In that you were offered a publishing deal?
Yeah, publisher came to me and said, oh, I really want a book about the legacy of Tiananmen 25 years on. Do you want to write it? And I kind of really didn't want to. My first answer was no, because I knew it'd be really hard to stay in China afterwards. And, you know, I'd worked really hard, learned Chinese, thought China was the most interesting place in the world to be based as a journalist, the most interesting stories, you know, really the center of the emerging world. And, you know, it would end my career as a journalist to do it. But I decided to write it because I just thought it was such an important story that needed to be told. And if I didn't write that book wouldn't get written. Probably nobody else would want to do it for the same reasons.
And did you find it a wrench to move from the rapid turnaround of journalism with, you know, immediate deadlines, immediate gratification of seeing your work in print to the long, slow burn of writing long form?
Well, not really. And I mean, remember, I was mainly an radio journalist reporting for NPR. So, you know, your work feels in many ways a lot more ephemeral than actually text reporter. I mean, you do a piece for online, but your primary customer is radio. So I really loved the opportunity of being able to write in a longer form. I found it really hard at first because I was so used to summing everything up in 90 seconds. You know, suddenly it was really difficult to express it in a longer form, but I really enjoy the opportunity of, you know, writing in a more literary fashion and having the chance to express yourself at length.
Now, I haven't read that book, but in Indelible City, you describe a moment where you move from reporting on activists painting protest signs in Hong Kong to helping paint the signs yourself. And you write in the book, I knew I was crossing a line from neutral reporter to voluntary participant in an active protest, and that in doing so, I was violating the cardinal tenet on which I had based a quarter century of journalistic endeavor. I want to ask you on how you've negotiated that line throughout your career, because I imagine it must have come up when you were writing about something as brutal as the suppression of Tiananmen Square. How did you negotiate that line between being an objective observer and having views about the issues on which you were reporting?
Well, I spent 8 years at the BBC and we had a very sort of clear editorial line there. You were there as an observer, not a participant. And I would say that's a line that has changed and moved and blurred over the years. And actually, after I left, the BBC had a catchphrase, live the story, which is very much not being removed from the story. It's being part of the story. But at the time when I was there and all throughout my training, the role of the journalist was very much seen as a kind of an observer, someone standing back from the action. And, you know, we would actually get told to write these stand back pieces where you're an outside observer standing back from the action. And I mean, you know, so that was what I was used to. And that was what I was doing in my day job. And, you know, as a news reporter, that's what you're expected to do. But in this case, for this book, it was different. I found it was harder for me to do that because I was not only a reporter, I was also a Hong Konger. I grew up there. I saw the city as my home. And I had, you know, a special connection with the city and with the story. And in a way, it was impossible to remove myself from the story when the city, Hong Kong, was already a part of me. And I also felt that the sort of voices of Hong Kongers were not being heard that much. There was a whole story that remained untold. And so that was what I wanted to do with that book. You know, I really felt that Hong Kong's story has always been told for it by colonial powers, first the British, now the Chinese. And I wanted to change the focus and write something that centers Hong Kong voices and Hong Kong people, and Hong Kong's own story is told by its own people.
So in the course of doing that, have you developed any particular thoughts on what that relationship should be between partisanship and neutrality for journalists, particularly for journalists who are reporting in, say, an authoritarian country? I mean, did that experience make you go back and rethink the BBC's very traditional rules on objectivity?
You know, I think there were real questions about objectivity and its use and who it serves. You know, if you're an Indigenous person reporting on Indigenous communities, is objectivity useful, or is your own inside particular knowledge more helpful? And I actually think that transparency is more important than objectivity if you have a position expressing what that position is. I also think that, for me, sort of accuracy was more important. You know, saying what I saw, or, you know, sourcing things that I knew, rather than, you know, saying on the one hand, on the other hand. I mean, another way of looking at it is, if we are reporting Ukraine, for example, you know, does objectivity require you to have a Russian voice in every story about Ukraine? I don't think that would be objective, right? If every story you had about a military movement, you had a Russian voice saying, well, this is not a war, this is a special military operation, I think that would change the tenor of the reporting. I don't think it would be accurate. And so, to my mind, the importance of neutrality and objectivity is less important than transparency and accuracy.
As a follow-up on that point, or at least a related point, maybe you could talk to us about the particular skill set a journalist needs when reporting inside a country where there is a great deal of censorship, and where, you know, you're conscious that the people that you're talking to may suffer as a result of your reporting. What did you learn about how that might be done?
I mean, I think what I learned was transparency is really important. If you're going to interview someone, it's important that they understand the consequences, or the possible consequences for them, and that, you know, you take the time to talk to your sources and to be clear about what they know, what you're going to do with this interview or whatever, and they're happy with that. And it can be really difficult. So for the book and for the podcast, a lot of the research and the recording was done before the national security legislation was imposed on Hong Kong. That happened in June 2020, and almost all the reporting had been done before that. And that meant that the situation had changed, right? People had given their consent to be interviewed at one point in time, and now the risks were different. So in almost every case where it was possible, I had to go back and talk to interviewees again and check they were happy with what they had said. Often, both for the book and the podcast, I would actually send them whole chunks of the book so they knew in what context their words were being used. It's not normal journalistic practice to let your interviewees see what they have said and approve it. But in this case, it was really important because, you know, there was a real risk for them. And, you know, the real problem is that you don't know how things are going to change again in the future. You can't kind of future-proof your reporting. And there's always a risk. So I think it's a really, really tricky reporting. And, you know, had I known what would happen in future, I don't know what I would have done differently. But taking all of those steps just made each process far longer than it would ordinarily have been.
Well, let's talk about that process and the King of Kowloon specifically. For those who haven't read the book or heard the podcast, where is Kowloon and who was its king?
So Kowloon is a peninsula opposite Hong Kong. Hong Kong really became Chinese in three separate stages. Hong Kong Island first in the 1840s, then the peninsula opposite Hong Kong, Kowloon, in the 1860s, and then the new territories. And the King of Kowloon was basically this very eccentric old man who everybody knew. When I was growing up in Hong Kong, he was incredibly famous. He was possibly mad. He was a trash collector, and he believed that the peninsula of Kowloon had been stolen from his family when it became British. And he called himself the King of Kowloon, and he would paint all over the walls and the flyovers, the post boxes, the lampposts, anything that was public property, he would paint on it in this really ugly calligraphy. It was like he'd had 2 years of schooling, so it was basically like a child's writing. And the government hated his work and they'd wash it off or paint over it. But he became an artist. He got an art exhibition and then he became really famous. He represented Hong Kong in the Venice Biennale. And eventually he became the most valuable artist in Hong Kong. So his work sells at Sotheby's. Was one piece sold for $250,000. Whoa. Yeah. And I mean, you know, more than that, he was this sort of iconic figure. You know, he was, people sang songs about him. The fashion designers used his work. You could buy like King of Kowloon commemorative whiskey and sneakers and underwear and duvet covers. And I just really love the journalistic mystery of this guy. But I also love the fact that he had become such an icon that when he died in 2007, the newspapers all printed these huge headlines saying, you know, the king is dead, long live the king is dead, his people are crying and mourning, the king is dead, who will succeed him? So I loved the idea that Hong Kong people had created this hero and they'd picked, you know, this total anti-hero, a very poor man, possibly insane, who people had thought of as a vandal in his time. And yet when he died, there was just this outpouring. So I just thought it was such an interesting story.
So in Indelible City, you write about deciding that you wanted to do something around the king, that you wanted to research and write about him, and then struggling to find a way to do so. So I want to ask you about your process. Once you became interested in him, did a particular medium come to mind, or was it initially a free-floating fascination? I mean, did you start recording audio right from the start, or how did it come about?
Oh, it was always meant to be a book, but I recorded everything. As a radio reporter, I just recorded all interviews in good quality, and I'd also been doing a lot of reporting for other outlets, for places like The New Yorker and other places. And so I was doing a lot of news interviews. You know, when the umbrella movement happened, I was there interviewing people and I just recorded everything. And I didn't know what I was going to do with it. I never intended it for it to be a podcast. I just had a lot of audio. And not only did I record everything, but I transcribed all my interviews at the time. And that was the thing, I think, that made things a lot easier. That was the reason I was able to do a podcast, because not only did I have all this sound, I also had all the transcripts. And that was like incredibly time consuming at the time. I mean, I had 8 years of sound, you know, hundreds of interviews.
So how then did the ABC podcast come about? Had they read the book and decided to do a podcast, or had you approached them, or what was the process by which that happened?
No, not at all. The book hadn't come out. I was approached by a commissioner, Kath Dwyer, who's in charge of spoken word audio at Radio National. And she just came to me and said, oh, I would be really interested in something China related, maybe. Have you got any ideas? And I had a couple of ideas that I shared with her, and she didn't like any of them. And then when we were just kind of chatting back and forth, and I just mentioned, oh, yeah, and I'm doing this other project. I'm writing this book. I've got all this sound. She was really into that idea, and she was like, well, maybe that could be a podcast.
You do your own Little Red podcast. Tell us about the difference between working on that as a project that you do and working on a project for the ABC as a podcast. How similar are they? How different are they?
It's totally different. It's a completely other level of resourcing. The Little Red podcast is myself and Graham Smith, who's a political scientist at ANU. We have one editor, Andy Hazel, who's a former student, and Wing Kwong, another student who does producing and sets up interviews for us, and that's it. For an ABC Audio Studios thing, it's just a total other level of resourcing. So I had a producer, Kirsty Melville, I had an executive producer, Sophie Townsend, I had people helping with research, I had a sound designer, the amazing Russell Stapleton, who wrote all of the music and did all the sound design. And then, you know, we had all of the kind of resources of the ABC, listening parties, this kind of thing, the whole, a whole process. But it was a much longer process as well. We took probably a year to put forward a proposal and get that approved, and then a year to do the podcast. And when I was looking to play some examples of the sound design and how it changed, I was just looking for examples for my class, and I found one version of the first episode, which was labeled version 56.
Whoa.
That's just the mix. That wasn't even the written edits. You know, in the written versions, we were up sort of version 20, 23. So it was just a much longer, more iterative, more involved process regarding a whole team of people.
It's not like your own podcast you can just bang out in one take.
Not at all.
If you could go back in time and give your younger self a piece of journalistic advice at the beginning of your career, with the full benefit of the wisdom that you've accrued over the years, what would it be?
Learn more tech skills. It would definitely be spend more time learning those tech skills, get better at video, get better at editing, learn how to scrape data, all of those tech skills. I think those are the skills that I'm lacking in. And, you know, nowadays, you really need to be able to do everything. So I'd also say, you know, like having your own outlet is also really good. Like having a podcast or something that you do yourself is also, I think, really important. And for me, it's been really good. So for the Little Red podcast has been a really good way of meeting people in the field that I'm interested in and of sort of keeping up to date on stuff. So I think that's been a nice thing. But I think I underestimated the importance of tech skills. And those are the things that I would really focus on.
That was The Yarn's executive producer, Louisa Lim, talking to Jeff Sparrow. The Yarn is from the Centre for Advice in Journalism at the University of Melbourne. It's produced on the land of the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nation. A massive thank you to Jeff and Louisa. See you next week.